In 1998, Martin Seligman was elected president of the American Psychological Association. And when he announced positive psychology as the theme of his term, the movement came into prominence among researchers, even being called the next wave in psychology. Positive psychology is called the science of human flourishing, or well-being, and it is an intentional effort to escape a particular problem that had afflicted earlier forms of clinical and theoretical psychology. Earlier forms of psychology focused on pathology and diagnosis, as embodied in various editions of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. The question of how to understand and treat abnormality was at the fore. Already with the so-called humanistic psychologies of Carl Rogers and Abraham Maslow, the call was made to shift focus from abnormality and pathology to psychological health and flourishing. The humanistic psychologists had already paved a way out of the previous behavioristic approaches that effectively denied that human beings have free will and conscious intentions. And the humanistic psychologists started to develop accounts based on the affirmation that human beings are conscious, intentional, and free agents who live by choice. What was needed, Maslow affirmed, was an account of human flourishing and full actualization. Positive psychology begins here, where Rogers and Maslow left off, and it aims to give us a scientifically verified account of flourishing. In his 2002 book, Authentic Happiness, and in subsequent publications, Seligman and others have no difficulty in speaking of happiness, eudaimonia, the good life, character strength, and virtues, all as part of a larger attempt to give an account of human potential fully actualized and flourishing. It is the rise of positive psychology as an area of academically and scientifically serious research that has led to the development of college courses on happiness, such as the one offered here at Yale. And I've been told that the course here has drawn upwards of 1,200 students. Positive psychologists affirm that human beings have an inherent drive for happiness, flourishing, or well-being, and that our choices may take us into or away from such flourishing. The question is what such flourishing consists of and how to enter into it. By speaking to such questions, the positive psychologists are speaking to one of the most profound human questions, and are renewing an ancient line of philosophical thought. Ancient philosophy was largely an attempt to pose the question of happiness in a most radical way, provide an answer to the question, as well as a set of means or lived strategies for being happy or living a good life. It can reasonably be said that Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics is the original positive psychology, owing much to his predecessors in Socrates and Plato. But Augustine, too, saw himself as speaking to the happiness question. One of the famous lines of Augustine is, "Everyone wants to be happy, and everyone will agree with those words as soon as they come out of my mouth." That's where Augustine's philosophical and theological project takes its lead, from the question of happiness. And Thomas Aquinas enjoys the position of inheriting both the Aristotelian and Augustinian lines of thought on the question of happiness, and presenting us with a sophisticated answer to it. The purpose of our conference today is to propose that in the wisdom of Thomas Aquinas, there is to be found a profound and perennially valid positive psychology, an answer to the question of happiness and flourishing. But it's of a different kind than than what is on offer today, and in some respects, it's better than what is on offer in contemporary positive psychology. One of the things I want to explore in this paper is, in what respects is the wisdom of Aquinas better than what's on offer in the contemporary positive psychology, even though there is a lot of overlap. Well, let's go through some basic things to start us off. We'll start with questions or points about metaphysics, or our understanding of reality as a whole. St. Thomas offers his answer to the question of happiness in terms of a larger metaphysical framework that is an account or understanding of reality as a whole and the fundamental structure of the world in which we live. As far as I can tell, positive psychologists don't have such ambitions. They remain quiet or silent about those ultimate questions of reality, but Aquinas doesn't. He has definite answers to questions about the ultimate constituents and principles of reality, and he answers the question of happiness in light of those larger metaphysical positions. So let's outline some basic points about his metaphysics. First of all, Aquinas is not a nominalist. A nominalist is someone who basically denies that things around us have natures or forms or specifically substantial forms. Aquinas holds that the things around us have natures, constitutive forms that make them to be what they are and to be the kind of thing that they are. Just by setting aside the nominalist position and embracing a robust account of natures or substantial forms, Aquinas already takes a definite position on the ultimate structure of reality. We live in a world of forms. But there's more to say about his metaphysics. Second, it's not mechanistic. He holds that things have ends or purposes, and the behavior and activities of things in the world around us cannot be accounted for exclusively in terms of material causes or efficient causes working pointlessly. Rather, the fullest and deepest account of the things around us, their behavior and their activities, is to be understood in light of their end towards which they act. Every agent acts for the sake of an end. It's one of the basic principles in Aquinas' metaphysics. And so, for Aquinas, we live not only in a world of form, but in a world of form and finality as well. It's a teleological universe, as Aquinas understands it. Now, that's important to note, that before we even start talking about human beings, or our activities, our choices, or anything like that, we're simply talking about the world around us as a whole, and about nature. It's important to note this because when we read either the humanist psychologists or positive psychologists, they're ready to say and openly affirm that all human beings have a drive for happiness or for full flourishing. That is basically a given within the contemporary field of research. But in a sense, it's limited to human beings in the contemporary field of research, as if the drive for happiness or teleological activity were something of an exception within an otherwise mechanistic or materialistic universe. For Aquinas, human beings are not exceptional as being goal-driven or end-driven agents. And we do have a drive for happiness. Of course, he acknowledges this, but the human drive for happiness and full flourishing is part of the teleological structure of nature and reality as a whole. And so there's a profound continuity between the structure of reality as a whole, the structure of nature, and the structure of human nature. It's not like we live in a materialistic universe where things are accounted for by material causes and efficient causes acting pointlessly, But then there's just this weird phenomenon called human beings who are centers of consciousness and have experience and free choice and intention and act for an end. There's not that kind of dichotomy there between human beings and the rest of the natural world. Rather, there's a deep continuity and coherence with the rest of the natural world because the natural world is teleologically ordered and we're part of it as teleologically ordered beings as well. Furthermore, human free choice for Aquinas is not this bizarre or unaccountable strange phenomenon that's just so utterly different from things around us operating in a world of mechanistic causes. No, that's not how he thinks of it. We do have free choice for Aquinas, but it's intelligible within a natural order that's understood in terms of forms and final causality and acting for the sake of an end. Aquinas has, within his philosophy of nature and in his metaphysics, a whole set of terms of analysis for understanding things with a nature and as acting for an end. Things have various powers that are built into them. And human beings have powers as well, particularly the powers of intellect and will. And intellect is for the sake of knowing truth or understanding the truth. And will is this power or capacity that's for the sake of loving the good or loving the apprehended good. And the apprehended good, that's the true good. That's what our intellect and will is for. And he's able to give an account of how free choice works when you think of it or understand it in terms of intellect and will interacting within the person. And when you understand human beings this way, our freedom is not simply this unintelligible phenomenon in an otherwise mechanistic universe. It's actually the terms of the explanation cohere with the rest of the philosophy of nature and the metaphysics as well. Now, there are probably some people here saying, okay, that's very interesting. Once upon a time, there was this ancient or old-fashioned way of thinking about nature and the world around us, which was a world of form and finality, and things had powers and inclinations, and their actions and behaviors could be accounted for in terms of these powers and inclinations and their teleological drive. But, so the story goes, that way of thinking about nature has gone the way of history. It's been surpassed and supplanted by a more sophisticated scientific understanding of the world. And so, of what relevance or use is this? Is St. Thomas's way of thinking about these things? Well, one response we can give is that contemporary philosophy and science has been moving gradually, you could say maybe groping in some way, towards the resurgence of the teleological principles of St. Thomas and the understanding of nature in substantial form. Nominalism and mechanistic thinking about the universe has come to face severe criticism in recent times, and even among thinkers far outside the school of Aquinas, you have a new understanding of form and finality coming to the fore again. The discussion of emergent properties is an important topic that provides some confirmation for a Thomistic way of thinking about nature and the structure of reality, especially about forms and essences, but also the irreducible teleological structure of the behavior that we find in activity in a lot of natural phenomena. A number of people have been coming to realize this and confirm more and more that the ancient teleological picture is not simply ridiculous or laughable or to be dismissed outright, but there's actually a way in which it can be received and become useful for explanatory purposes in contemporary contexts. So we can't just simply say that the principles of nature that we find in Thomas Aquinas are simply outdated or no longer relevant or anything like that. It's much more nuanced and a much more complicated conversation. But now we can start to ask ourselves a little bit more specifically, in what way is Aquinas' wisdom about happiness, human happiness and flourishing, in what ways might it be better than what's on offer in a good deal of the contemporary positive psychology? Well, we can go a little bit further. Thomas Aquinas' account of human flourishing or happiness is not relativistic or subjectivistic. It's based on human nature, not simply our experience of ourselves day in and day out in a simplistic kind of way, or the analysis of our internal consciousness or in an introspective kind of way. It's rather based on an understanding of our nature or substantial form, and on our end, a common human nature. And a common end provides a common criterion for measuring our choices. It seems to me that, is this lacking, we can ask, in some contemporary positive psychology? An understanding of a shared human nature with a shared end that constitutes a criterion, a common criterion, for measuring our choices and whether they'll conduce to flourishing or not? Or is the contemporary positive psychology still, we could say, perhaps stuck in a way of thinking of human beings as primarily a center of consciousness, having interior experiences that are going on all the time, and we basically compare our experience back and forth and develop an account of happiness for you, or happiness for this person over here, or that person there? Aquinas is able to transcend that kind of subjectivism or relativism in his answer to the question of happiness. It's not a wholly subjective matter, happiness and flourishing. There is a truth of the matter. And some choices really are detrimental to the flourishing of beings of our kind, even if they may feel good in the moment or be conducive to certain states of emotional satisfaction for a period of time. So let's try to spell out in more detail now Aquinas's, we could say, positive psychology. It's really some perennial principles about human nature that speak to the question of happiness and speak directly into debates within positive psychology today. And what I'm going to do is lay out his understanding in terms of five principles. Okay? So we call five principles of human nature and happiness according to Thomas Aquinas. And this is going to be a very general kind of overview, with the understanding that over the course of the day we're going to fill in a lot of the details. So, the first principle in Aquinas' understanding of human nature and happiness. The first principle is, all human beings by nature have an end. That end is happiness, flourishing, well-being. Now, it's important to note when we say this that the expression by nature, it's not just like we simply have this desire, but one may, as it were, give up and no longer be a kind of being that seeks happiness in some way or seeks flourishing. No, it's in us by nature. That means it's something that's written into us, and all human beings everywhere are going to go in search of the end. They're going to go in search of happiness. And if someone has given up that search, if someone is no longer asking the happiness question or striving to answer it or striving to come into happiness, we would reasonably say something's gone wrong in this person's life. We could reasonably say that because beings of our kind, by our nature, strive for human happiness, flourishing, or well-being. So that's the first thesis. We have an end. Now I need to make some qualifications about this a little bit further. When I say the term end, and that human beings by nature have an end, I don't mean a totally subjective personal intention. I mean something like, we have an end that's fixed for beings of our kind. And it's not fixed by a particular person in a particular subjective condition or not. So we couldn't just say, you know what, human happiness, I think happiness and flourishing consists in being just melancholic and down all the time, and I just think that's what happiness is. That's what happiness is for me. Or I think happiness consists in ruling the universe, and that's just what happiness consists in for me. For that's what it is. Okay. No, that's not what we mean by end. The end is not just a subjective intention that a person has. It's an actual goal or destination fixed by nature, a state or a condition that by nature we seek out, or are working towards, acting towards. And it's quite well possible on this account that you could have some individuals who in their experience or their subjective life and their interiority might very well intend particular courses of action that seem to them to be what will make them happy, but are in fact incompatible with that fixed end, the end that's fixed for beings of our kind. So that might be something we talk about, ends versus subjective intentions. There's a difference. Okay, the second thesis. Number two, human beings by nature have a form, or as we put it earlier, in nature, a substantial form that makes us the kind of being that we are. It's because we have a common substantial form or a nature that we're going to have common needs, common behaviors, common perfections. Why is it that all human beings, adults or almost all human beings, nearly all times, nearly all places, require sleep, for example, or food? It's because we have a common nature. Okay, and common needs. That's the second thesis. All human beings by nature have a form. Now, there's a kind of correspondence between our nature or our form and our end. Okay? They're not just two things juxtaposed with one another. The way that Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas understood our form is that it's developmental. It's moving in a direction. And so it's not just a static or fixed plan. It's not just an organizational structure. A lot of times when people hear the term form, they might think of shape, plan, blueprint, something like that. No, they have in mind something deeper than that. Our form is an order to our parts. That's for sure. It is that. But it's more than just that. It's also a kind of interior propensity or a drive to develop in a certain direction, in certain ways, proper to things of that form, over time, towards an optimal state, the end, full flourishing. That's what our form is. And so, I mean, this is why we see things around us in nature, things of the same kind tend to develop in the same ways over time. Trees develop in a certain way over time. Cats develop in a certain way over time. And they develop in patterns common to their species or their kind. So it is with human beings. We tend to develop and grow and move in a direction proper to our kind. Our form, then, is an inherent tendency towards our end, towards this state of full flourishing or optimal condition. Okay? So that's kind of written into the notion of form. But we're going to get a little bit more specific now about form, or the human form in particular. So the third thesis or principle. All human beings by nature have five inclinations. We can call them the five natural inclinations of human beings. All human beings by nature have five inclinations. And it's important to get clear on these inclinations because if Thomas Aquinas is right, these are written in, so to speak, to every human being, whoever was, is now, or ever will be. And they have an important place in his account of flourishing or happiness for human beings. So let's go through the five inclinations quickly. I won't labor them greatly. We can talk about them in Q&A if you find them terribly controversial. I'll try to clarify them a little bit as we go. So the first inclination is for goodness as such. For goodness as such. Okay? All the things around us, it's part of it, it's a metaphysical thesis of Aquinas, that all the things around us, all beings, are aiming for their full perfection, so they're striving for the good. So just to be is good. And the perfections that things display are good. And so human beings, too, have this innate inclination, or we could say drive, for the good, for what's going to perfect us. Yes, it's that, but not just for like the perfection of our own constitution. It's more than that. The way that Thomas Aquinas understands this inclination for the good, as it works in human beings, is that it is a longing for what he calls the whole good, the bonum universale, the whole good. It's this hunger within for all that is good, the totality of goodness, of every good thing. And in this way, there's something mysterious about human beings. We have an inclination or an appetite for something that exceeds our finite kind of location in space and time and our finite present condition. We have a longing for, we can say, the whole good or the universal good. Everything that is good whatsoever, it summons us. It calls us. It moves us. It's attractive. And we can't be content with what's less than this. This whole good. We keep looking for it more and more. And there's a great number of philosophical observations that could be made about this. What are the implications for this of this reality that we long for the totality of goodness, for all of it, for the whole of it? And we can't really rest content with passing transitory sorts of things. There's implications there that really need to be thought out deeply. Okay? And it's part of what we'll talk about a little bit more later. Okay, there's a second inclination of our nature, which is the inclination for life. All human beings want to live. They want to live. Now, I know as soon as I say that, there will be a kind of counterexample raised. Say, well, what about all the people who are depressed or want to commit suicide or something like that? Yes, Aquinas is quite well aware of that phenomenon, and we are too, but let's just point something else out, that when someone is, let's say, in a clinical context and declares and says, I want to kill myself and I have a plan to do so, we all understand that's a crisis situation. And there are measures and protocols we take in order to assist people who are in those circumstances. And if you go, or someone who's in that condition, goes to an emergency room or checks into a hospital and says, I want to kill myself and I have a plan to do so, we will restrain that person, even against their consent. Why do we do that? It's because all human beings recognize that we want to live. And if you don't want to live, something's gone terribly wrong. Something is out of order. Something needs to be corrected or rectified. The person needs help. So that's a kind of indication that all human beings have the desire to live, and all human beings recognize it, that all human beings have the inclination to live, the way that we treat those who are suicidal. But we can talk more about that. There's a third fundamental inclination of human beings, and that is for life in society. We want to be together, to work together, act together, live together. And the person who wants to be simply alone seems strange, anomalous. That's why hermits strike us as really weird. Why do we think of hermits as really weird? Well, they could live in society with the rest of us and be part of like the common project of life together, but instead they go off and they live in a cave on their own. That strikes us as weird. Why does that strike us as strange? It strikes us as strange precisely because all human beings, by nature, are inclined to live together, in community, in society, and to work together for common ends and goods. There's a fourth inclination that's important, or that's on Aquinas' list, we should say, and that's the inclination for the reproduction and education of offspring. All human beings, by nature, seek the preservation of our race. And not just to kind of biologically reproduce more human beings, but actually to educate them. It's a matter of concern as to how the next generation is raised. And that's a universal phenomenon. And historians are typically in the business of saying that when the birth rate in a society declines, when birth rates decline, that's a telltale sign to historians that that society is in decline. It just won't last. We need to reproduce and educate our offspring. Okay, so that's an inclination of our nature. The fifth inclination, which is perhaps the most important for our purposes, that Aquinas recognizes as somehow touching the deepest thing within us, our very rational life, the life of the mind, is the inclination for truth. All human beings, by nature, desire to understand. That's the first line of Aristotle's Metaphysics, and Aquinas takes that as a statement of the truth. We want truth. No one wants to be lied to. Augustine puts it this way, I have met many people who want to deceive, but none who want to be deceived. That's an indication of the universal inclination for truth. But Aquinas adds an important qualification. He says, everyone wants to know the truth, especially the truth about God. We're all seeking the cause of the order of the world. We want an explanation, an ultimate explanation for the order, the beauty, the harmony of the world around us. And that's an important part of the story of our fulfillment. There's an implication here. And the implication is that human beings cannot be said to have arrived at our end unless we have some knowledge of God. At least that God exists and is responsible for the order of the universe. A human being who could be a kind of fully satisfied agnostic or a fully satisfied atheist, Aquinas just doesn't think that's possible. Okay? He thinks that it's a critical part of the story of our flourishing that we'd be able to develop ways to think about God reasonably and arrive at verified answers about God. Now, he also recognizes there's various degrees and orders of knowledge of God. That's an important distinction we can leave aside. We just want to note it here. But any account of human flourishing that sort of leaves human beings as, how shall I put it, essentially agnostic or happily content with knowing nothing whatsoever about God, Aquinas just doesn't think that's realistic. It's not compatible with our nature. We're inclined, we're driven to know truth and the ultimate truth, the truth about God. That's a very important observation. The fourth thesis in Aquinas' account of human nature and flourishing, the fourth thesis is this: humans by nature choose their way to the fulfillment of these inclinations in concrete circumstances. All human beings by nature choose their way to the fulfillment of these inclinations in concrete circumstances. So Aquinas thinks of us as free agents who have responsibility for our actions. We deliberate about the ways and means to the end for us, our optimal state or our optimal condition. What is our optimal state or our optimal condition? It is the full state in which these five inclinations are fulfilled. Not just any inclination, not just any personal preference, not just any subjective desire, and especially not those preferences or subjective desires, the fulfillment of which is incompatible with the fulfillment of these inclinations. Okay? Those desires, preferences, or subjective kind of felt needs, to the extent that they're incompatible with these inclinations, they're not going to make us happy. They're not going to be the way to flourishing. And acting on them is not going to get us there. Our end is fixed by nature. These inclinations specify, we could say, a general account of the end to human beings. And what's left to us is the responsibility to deliberate over the means to the fulfillment of these ends and to choose means that will actually get us there. Not those that simply look like they will but won't. And we make these choices in concrete circumstances, in the middle of your life and mine, in the actual circumstances in which we find ourselves. So human beings are free agents. And lastly, the fifth thesis, or the fifth principle in Aquinas' account of human nature and human flourishing, is that happiness is life according to reason. Happiness is life according to reason. We could say that's a general answer to the question, what is happiness? And Aquinas takes that answer straight from Aristotle, who gave the same answer. Now, what does that mean, life according to reason? Aristotle spells it out in his Nicomachean Ethics, and that book is famous for leaving the reader with a certain puzzle or question about just what that expression means. Because there's kind of two discussions of the meaning of life according to reason in the Nicomachean Ethics. One discussion is about, we could say, life in the city among other human beings. The life of a citizen in the polis. And what is life according to reason if you're thinking of kind of human beings living in the city, going about their business and their affairs? Happiness, we could say, or life according to reason, we should say, is rationally moderated behavior of a citizen in a city, okay, who's making a contribution to the common good. That's what life according to reason basically means for Aristotle. It's rationally moderated behavior of a citizen in the city who's contributing to the common good, to the good of the whole. We could also call this virtue. Virtue is this disposition of character to choose the path of, we could say, rationally moderated behavior, to choose to act according to the mean of virtue. That's what life according to reason is. And Aristotle has this famous, extensive discussion of the various virtues that a person needs in order to live and to live well in the city, to live according to the mean. Okay? Life according to reason is basically life according to the mean of virtue, as determined by phronesis or prudence. Okay? But there's another and a second sense of life according to reason that's taken up by Aristotle in the last book of the Nicomachemes, where he says, wait a second, life according to reason might also be life according to what's highest and best within us, meaning that power of the soul which is the most noble, which is our reason itself. And happiness really consists of the life of contemplation. Okay? That's life according to reason. You could say the full realization of the potentiality latent within reason itself to understand the ultimate causes of the universe. That's full flourishing for a human being. That's happiness for us. It's contemplation of the ultimate and the highest cause. Okay? Or the contemplation of God. That's how St. Thomas interprets that last chapter of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. But that's very interesting, because that means that the story of our flourishing, of our happiness, really leads us ultimately to the claim that happiness consists of, or at least a very good case can be made that it consists of, the contemplation of God. Those are some general principles in Aquinas' account of human nature and human flourishing. On that account, which we're going to fill in over the course of the day, I want to propose we have something that's better than what's on offer in some of the contemporary positive psychology, even though there's a lot of overlap and room for a huge dialogue with the positive psychology. What's better? I'm going to give three things. There are three things in Aquinas' account of human nature and flourishing that's better than what's on offer in the contemporary positive psychology. Number one, on Aquinas' account, there's an objectivity about happiness. There's an objectivity about what it consists of. There is a fixed human nature with a fixed end that has a common constitution or order. That's the same for all of us, given these five inclinations of our nature. And that is the case independently of our subjective experience, moods, feelings, or situations or conditions that we might be in. It seems to me that a lot of the contemporary positive psychology has a lingering subjectivism and relativism in it that's left over from some of the humanistic psychology of its predecessors, where there's a fear to say, well, I don't want to impose any definite account of what happiness consists of. Maybe there is no truth about that. But I want you to flourish according to your own understanding and your own intentions about what human happiness and flourishing is, or what flourishing is for you. So a lot of it can be left, a lot of the contemporary psychology can be left as a form of kind of life coaching in a subjectivistic project. Like you have your subjective project, and the psychologist will coach you along in your life choice, just whatever it may be. Okay. There's still, I think, a lingering element of that. And also, there's with the emphasis on wanting to sort of verify everything scientifically, there's a concern about whether it's not just a scientific project, but perhaps a scientistic project that does not allow for anything higher than the realities of nature to factor into its account of things. Okay? That leads to my second point. Aquinas' account of happiness is better because it leaves open the possibility and need for human beings to engage in transcendental thinking. Okay? Human beings by nature ask large questions that transcend the things of nature. For example, what is the whole good, this bonum universale? We ask that question. Or what is it that's infinitely good? What's the eternal good? Those questions transcend what's empirically verifiable. They're about ultimate or metaphysical realities and theological realities. Human beings need to think an answer to the happiness question in a way that's beyond what scientific method affords us, especially if God is part of the answer. And if contemporary methods in positive psychology foreclose on us thinking in this transcendental way, or if they foreclose on us actually arriving at some truth about God, then they would actually get in the way of positive flourishing on Aquinas' understanding of things. So, does the positive psychology that's on offer today, does it have a lingering humanism in it, or a lingering naturalism? Is it attempting to spell out an account of happiness in terms of this life only, without God as part of the answer, or without the knowledge of God as a part of the answer? That's something Aquinas offers that I think the contemporary positive psychology does not. So let's get more specific. This is my third and final point about what's better in Aquinas, and that is the answer to the God question. Human beings are happy in proportion to the degree that we come into contact with the truth and the love of God. We could say that's a principle of Aquinas' understanding of our happiness. Human beings are happy in proportion to the degree that we come into contact with the truth and the love of God. And Aquinas provides a way for humans to approach God rationally. He has a deep and rich account of philosophical psychology and revealed theology. And he has worked out a way in which human beings can learn to think about God and arrive at true answers to the question, to the God question, including questions about how we can come into contact with God and the love of God, especially when you bring divine revelation into that. Aquinas provides a way for us to do this. The contemporary positive psychology, it seems, doesn't provide this. It has this kind of lingering naturalism written into it. Or maybe I'm not aware of any authors who propose that philosophical theology and revealed theology are themselves critical, necessary strategies for human beings to take up in the cause of human flourishing. Maybe there are such authors. I'm not aware of them, though. It seems to me that the account of flourishing is spelled out in terms mainly of this life only. So that brings us to the close. And what we're going to do over the course of the rest of the conference is fill out a lot of the details of that picture that I gave you. And we're going to focus on things that that fill in the details regarding a number of questions that I'm sure you have. So what we'll do right now is have time for a little bit of Q&A. But then we'll have many more of the questions filled in over the course of the day. Thank you.
I was wondering if there's often a conflict between a life according to reason and a life according to love. So, for example, if you have a person, say a small child who doesn't even know how to reason or think very well, but that person or child loves God, truly loves God, isn't that kind of person the happiest of all? Isn't that kind of person truly happy?
That's a good question, and we don't want to think in terms of a dichotomy between life according to reason and life according to love. There's two reasons for saying that. I think first, Aristotle himself in the Nicomachean Ethics saw the topic of friendship. saw friendship as critical to the account of happiness. We're going to have a talk on that today. So even kind of from a Greek pagan perspective, friendship and love is an essential part of the story. But Aquinas has something going that Aristotle doesn't. He has a whole Augustinian line of thought on this. And there's no doubt that for Augustine, there's no happy life without the life of love and the enjoyment of the God of love. And the enjoyment of the God of love can take place even without a high degree of intellectual sophistication or understanding. And Aquinas definitely has that Augustinian line of thought as well in his thinking, and he has a unique kind of synthesis of those two. Unfortunately, in presentations of Aquinas, like the one that I just gave, the story about love is often left out of it. We tend to focus on the Aristotelian principles and then bring in love later. And that can give a false impression. So I'm glad you asked that question. Love is a critical part of the story. So we're going to have a whole talk today on friendship and love.
In talking about this idea of the necessity for God in positive psychology and well-being, why should we believe that the Christian God or the Catholic God, you know, is the true and righteous one, and why not the Hindu God or the sure. Jewish gods? Like, what is so special in your mind about the Christian God versus just the search for meaning in other gods and religions?
Sure, good question. If I can speak, as it were, on behalf of Aquinas or in the way he would have, I mean, I think he would just object off the bat to any kind of characterization of God according to a finite perspective. So it's like what we have is when you talk about the Christian God or the Hindu God or something like that, you take a perspective of a human being, a religious perspective or a theological perspective, and you qualify God, who's the transcendent principle, who exists prior to any perspectives, you qualify that being with some kind of subjective, in the name of a perspective. You see that? So I think Aquinas would say, there's just no such thing as the God of Christianity or Islam or Hinduism or anything like that. There's one God. There's just one. And all human beings, by nature, regardless of religious affiliation, are capable of using their reason to arrive at some truth, limited, but still truth, some limited truth about God. So there can be a common human understanding of God. That's neither just Christian, nor just Muslim, nor just Jewish or Hindu or whatever. It's just the truth about God. And that's what we really want. I mean, after all, who wants to say, well, I'm happy ultimately with my God, with my personal, or my perspective, God, the God of my perspective. We don't want the God of my perspective. We want the God who is beyond all perspectives. And that's what's open to us to find. Now, that very proposal that I just made may come to a lot of people as like a totally unheard of proposal. And that's one of the points I'm trying to make. Aquinas has, within his account of human flourishing, resources to say, no, human beings really are able to arrive at knowledge of the one God who is. And in order for us, in common, as a race, to be happy, we need to know that God. And we can do that together. Now, there's also, he acknowledges, there's different accounts of revelation, whether that God has spoken or not. And he has ways of adjudicating those questions, too. So that's the proposal, is that in order for us to be happy, we need not a perspective about God, but the truth beyond all perspectives about God.
Okay, so first, thank you very much for the lecture. I really appreciate that.
Sure.
Just following the previous question, but I guess there should be a distinction between the God of philosopher and the God of Christians. I guess the one you just described is more like a God of philosopher, the first cause, the first principle, But I don't think you can just say the God of philosopher is the Christian God.
I think Thomas would. Thank you for the question. I think he would just simply disagree. So he thinks that it is possible for human beings to arrive at some truth about God. But again, I don't think you would want to qualify that as a God of the philosophers. It's just he who is. A God who is beyond any one of our particular perspectives. Okay. Now, Aquinas is aware of the arguments for the existence of God, and he deploys some of them and changes them and varies enhances them, I think, according to his own lights and distinctions and insights. But he really thinks that the God that you can arrive at through philosophy, let's call it the source of all contingent being, okay? There's many different names or titles by which we could call such a God, first mover, first cause, etc. He thinks that that is the God of Christianity. Okay? But what Christianity does is tells us more, or what we should say, God himself tells us more of himself, okay, which comes down to us in the Christian church. Okay? But it's not a different God or a separate God. It's the same one whom the philosophers catch a glimpse of. And there's a relatively straightforward reason for saying that, and that is because if you look at the Christian scriptures, or what Aquinas would call the divine revelation, God's revelation of himself, you will find in the scriptures God applying to himself titles that are in the philosophers. Okay, so God uses the language of the philosophers to describe himself. So in him we live and move and have our being. Therefore from him and through him and for him all things are. I am he who is I am. Those three sentences from different passages of scripture. Or the Book of Wisdom calls them simply the one from whom all things have their being. Those are highly, you could say, philosophical descriptions. But they're used in the scriptures. So the understanding Aquinas has is that God himself is using the language of the philosophers to connect, you know, the God who's being revealed in scriptures with the God discovered in philosophy. Yeah.
But if you can make a quick comparison between the Gospel of John and the Upanishad,
yes,
you can say in the Upanishad, even the Hindu God or Hindu goddess, they even use more philosophical characteristic to explain themselves.
Okay, so that's an interesting claim. When it would come to Aquinas, would think it's possible for people from, we could say, the Far East and the West to come together and arrive at some common conclusions. I mean, it's in principle possible for them to arrive at common conclusions about God. And Aquinas would not object to saying that there is in the Upanishad some, the expression of some natural knowledge of God. He says that about the Quran. There is in the Quran some truth about God. It's the truth that can be arrived at in philosophy. So I just don't know if I need to say there's no truth in the Upanishads about God. Now, you might go further and ask, well, why then should I accept the scriptures over the Upanishads? That's another question. Yeah, that's another question.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bench, I have one more question.
So you're explaining like different advantages that Aquinas' view of happiness has over positive psychology. One of them is that it's an objective definition of happiness as opposed to a subjective one.
Yeah, or at least more objective.
Okay, so that is a difference between them, but why is it preferable to be an objective definition?
Oh, that's a good question. One reason is because Aquinas' account of happiness doesn't just serve to give us, we could say, clinical help or kind of coaching or strategies along the way to happiness, although it does do that for sure. I also think it's the basis for moral principles and moral conclusions and moral reasoning. So we tend to think of there's psychology over here, and then there's morality over here. And these two things kind of have like nothing to do with each other. That's sort of a starting point for us in our contemporary condition. But for Aquinas, that's just not the case. For him, morality really is like a normative account of how to arrive at this objective flourishing. And that's why the norms themselves are objective. The norms, the guidelines, the practical guiding principles of morality are objective because the end of our nature is fixed and objective. Yeah. Now that being said, there's still plenty of room within Aquinas' account of happiness for what we might call some subjectivity. So written into the definition of virtue is that the virtuous man follows the mean relative to us as determined by the man of practical reason. That phrase, relative to us, is very important, and it tells us that when it comes to highly particular situations, there is it's not going to be exactly the same answer for every person in every set of circumstances. So there's a common answer to the question of happiness that's objective and universal, that grounds certain objective universal moral norms. And then as we descend into details, there's room for subjective variation and some relativity. It's a very sophisticated account.